Mark chapter 9, and we continue in the same chapter we looked at last week. We looked at the metamorphosis, the theologians call it the transfiguration, where briefly the three problem children of the disciples got to get a glimpse of Jesus the way he really is. And Matthew tells us that when Jesus was transfigured before them, that his clothing was shining because light was radiating out of him. Just the opposite of reflecting. He was the source of light and is shining right out through his clothes. Strong word in Greek. And that would leave a mark on you. Today we look at what happens when he comes back from with Peter, James, and John from that wonderful experience. It's kind of pathetic. Every time I see how pathetic the disciples are, it encourages me in an obtuse kind of a way, because I realize he prayed all night before he picked these 12 guys. And they were bozos a lot of the time. He had to repeat himself over and over, which he was willing to do. He loved them. He was persistent. They eventually did get it. I find all of that so encouraging. You know what? If they were 12 superheroes, you know, that never said anything wrong, that always immediately learned every spiritual lesson, I would find that really discouraging, because I don't learn that way. But when I see the people he picked that he was faithful to, makes me love him more, and it gives me great hope. And so we get to see what he's like. We get to see what people are like, so we can learn to not be that way. And we get to look at a couple of really important principles today. I'm looking forward to it. I'll begin reading at verse 14 of Mark chapter 9. Jesus and the disciples are coming down. Well, the three of the disciples are coming down from that wonderful experience. And now we get to see what the other nine were doing. They were being church people in the baddest sense of that, in the worst sense of that word. I'm sorry, baddest means something different in the neighborhood I came from. Verse 14, Mark 9. When they came to the other disciples, that is when they came down the mountain, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. You know, it's the thing that some religious people like to do. As soon as all of the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder, ran to greet him. It makes you wonder if he was still glowing. What are you arguing with them about? I've always wished I could see the look on his face in the Bob version of the movie where I'm the director. Jesus is looking at him like, how could you let yourself get sucked into this? You know better than this. And so now we get to see one of the first examples in the Gospels of tattling. In verse 17, another thing that church people are good at. A man in the crowd answered. He didn't ask the man in the crowd. He asked the disciples what they were arguing. But a man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son, who's possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground, and he foams at the mouth and gnashes his teeth and becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to drive out that spirit, but they could not." One of the few times that in Scripture that you will see Jesus frustrated. It's really clear language. He was just frustrated with them. "O unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." By the way, that's the, I think, the very best advice that any parent could hear, whether they have a boy or a girl or both. Bring him to Jesus. Verse 20. And so they brought him. And when the spirit, small s, the demon, saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. And he fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. That had to be horrifying to watch, especially if you're the father. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like that?" I think there's a reason for that question, not idle curiosity. "From childhood," he answered. "It's often thrown him into fire or water to kill him." Note these next few words. "But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." There's a little bit of a linguistic difficulty that we'll talk about here today. My NIV renders it properly. "If you can," Jesus said, "everything is possible for him who believes." And we need, that's a very popular statement, but we need to qualify what believes means. It doesn't mean, it's not an Oprah-ism. It's not "everything is possible to him who believes everything is possible." It's specifically talking about putting your faith in God and his ability. So it might be good to underline that phrase, "everything is possible to him as believe who believes." Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed. It's a really strong emotional word in Greek. And it's present tense, meaning "I am believing, but help me overcome my unbelief." That is a great prayer. Must have made Jesus smile to hear that kind of honesty. Because so many times his followers, especially men, are posturing. We won't admit that our faith is weak. It's all about flexing our muscles in front of everybody. I say amen. Every time I have a Bible I have, I write amen to this guy's statement. "I am believing, but help me overcome my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the evil spirit, the demon. He said, "You deaf and mute spirit, I command you, come out of him. Never enter him again." The spirit shrieked and convulsed him violently and then came out. There's a little glimpse into the nature of resistance. The spirit didn't have a choice. It had to yield to the superior power, but it's interesting just to notice the resistance. And that explains a lot of the battle that you and I face in our lives. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. And after Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, "Why couldn't we drive it out?" And Jesus replied, "This kind," implying that there are different sorts of demonic spirits, "this kind can only come out by prayer." Some of the older some manuscripts add the phrase "and fasting." If you have a study Bible, it probably footnotes that. Matthew also adds one statement that I think ought to be inserted here in Matthew's account of this in Matthew 17. When the disciples said, "Why couldn't we do it?" Jesus said, "Because of your unbelief." And we'll talk about that, because if you remember in chapter 3 and chapter 6, Jesus gave them the authority and the power to cast out evil spirits, which they had been doing successfully. So it's an interesting point. Why couldn't they do it now? And they left that place and they passed through Galilee. Jesus didn't want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching. his disciples. He didn't want to fight off the crowds when he was trying to give instructions. And he said to them, and anybody counting how many times this is he's going to tell them that he's going to die and be raised from the dead. My count is that this is the fourth time he said it to them clearly. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of other men. They will kill him. After 3 days, he will rise from the dead. But they didn't understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask him about it. I love what Steve Brown says in his radio program. He says, the only dumb question is the one you don't ask. So let's rewind. That's as far as we'll get today, but there's a lot of important stuff in here. There are a couple of rabbit trails that I think are important simply because they examine all of this. I have to make this disclaimer, okay? I'll make all my disclaimers right now. I'm not mad at anybody. I have nobody in mind with some of the things I'm talking about. There are problems that are endemic to God's people. And I think we need to address them. It may make some things clearer to us. That's my hope. That's my prayer. I think that one of the reasons that the foibles and failings of the disciples are recorded is not only so that we'll see God's grace in action, but also that it would give us a realistic picture of what it means to be a follower. And that doesn't mean I always get it. It means I intend to, and I'm doing the best that I can, and the patience of God, if I continue to follow him, is that he will teach me. But I can learn from the mistakes of others. I'd much rather learn from the mistakes of others than to learn from my own mistakes. Been there, done that too. So let's back up to verse 14, which is the beginning of the passage that we're looking at today. They came down the mountain, the three that went up, Peter, James, and John. We said last week those were the three problem children. I know that some of you had never heard that before. I'll never forget the first time I ever heard that. All of the sermons that I had preached, I had always thought Peter, James, and John were the special ones. You know, but if you really look at the evidence, they were the ones that were always getting into trouble. And it's very revealing to look at how Jesus treated them. It was the three that were the problem that he always kept with himself. They got to participate in some things that you'd think it would be a reward for being wonderful. That tells me a lot about his heart too. How does Jesus treat the problem children? He says, okay, you three, you're with me. Stick with me. I always think of that when we sing that song, Jesus, draw me close, closer, Lord, to you. It's like, Lord, you know, if you let me go out there, I'll do something dumb. You know I will. So just keep me close. So the three problem children and Jesus come back from this glorious experience, which in last week's episode, we realized they still were not totally on the clue bus. They saw the clue bus, they were at the clue bus stop, but they hadn't actually climbed on it yet, despite this really wonderful thing that happened to them. That also encourages me, because they will eventually climb on the clue bus and go all the way to the back and sit back there, and that's our great hope, isn't it? That will be us. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. It's tragic is I don't think that's an exaggeration. Tragic is probably the best way to describe the fact that church people have a reputation for loving to argue, despite the fact that the Bible is filled with admonition to not argue. In the pastoral epistles, I'm thinking of twice Paul told Timothy and once he told Titus, do not quarrel. He said, a man of God should not be an arguer. is that the experience that most of us have had? Well, no. You would think that he said just the opposite of that by how much church people love to argue. And one of the reason that I brought that up is because it is fairly typical that the other guys, the teachers of the law, were arguing. What was pathetic is that Jesus' disciples were arguing with them. You've been there, I know you have, where you could just let it go. You could just let it slide and say, I don't, you know, let's not go there. But somebody says something, they poke you. They poke you in that little pride spot where now you're now my, you know, my reputation's at stake. And then we just get, we get sucked right into that thing. Why is that bad? I think this episode tells us why it's bad. Paul told Timothy, the reason that you should not even enter into a discussion that you know is going to an argument, he said, because those that listen suffer. And I think that's a big clue as to why this little stage direction is given to us in this account. Why do we need to know that they were arguing with the teachers of the law? Because of what happens next. There was a need that was not being met, that Jesus had empowered his disciples to meet. He'd given them the authority. He had given them the power. They couldn't do it. And one of the reasons, well, the bottom line reason is they weren't relying on God's power. But the reason they weren't relying on God's power is because they were arguing. The devil is so good at what he does. We have certain people that push our buttons. And the ones that really push our buttons know just the thing to say. It was always that way with me and my brother. It's not like that now, which I'm grateful for. We both fell on our lips enough and trusted in God's mercy enough that we became good friends. But when there was still the sibling thing, he knew exactly the thing to say to just get me, as they say in Texas, riled up. You know, just where I, you know, my normal mild-mannered persona would get sucked right into, and the voice level immediately starts rising in a, you know, meteoric speed. So here are Jesus' disciples, which chapter 3 and chapter 6 tell us that had a successful ministry of healing and of casting demons out of people that were hopelessly bound, way in over their heads. He gave them authority, and they were successful at it. But now here's a guy comes in desperate need. He actually comes to see Jesus. He doesn't get to Jesus because Jesus is in a different place up on the mountain. I'm really excited for those of you that are going to Israel with us in a couple of months, because you'll never be able to read this passage again without picturing the place and picturing the mountain and the smells and all of that. It's quite thrilling. But it makes me very sad that they fell for this. I think all it takes to stop a work of God is for Christians to argue with each other. I've seen churches split over the absolute silliest things. Color of the carpeting. I've seen building programs completely derail the mission that the church has because Jesus isn't the middle of things anymore. Love for one another. All the admonition that we've been given to love one another, like we talked about on Wednesday night, and how that covers a multitude of sins. And we just fall for the silliest trap. We start arguing about things that in themselves are of lesser importance. And if you look at this story, the most important thing these guys could have done would have been to be filled with the Spirit so that any need that arises, they could be the solution. So hold that thought. I think the fact that they're arguing. If you were with us when we studied Nehemiah, and I know many of you weren't, but I think it is online. We did a whole study in the enemy's tactics that are beautifully laid out there in the book of Nehemiah. But one of the things that the enemy did to stop the work of God was just to get God's people arguing. Nothing gets done if all you're doing, you're wasting all your energy arguing. So it is a ploy, and I'll tell you, the enemy's good at it. And they fell for it. So verse 15 says, when the crowd saw Jesus, they were filled with wonder. Obviously, I think his face was glowing. I mean, if Moses' face was glowing when he came down from the mountain and he was just reflecting the glory of God, how much more it would have been if he had been the source of that light himself, like Jesus was in this account. Notice how many times Jesus asked the disciples stuff that he already knew the answer to. One little piece of advice from somebody who's learned the hard way. If God asks you a question, take it seriously, answer it. There's a reason why he asked you the question. It wasn't because he didn't know the answer. It was because we didn't realize the answer. We hadn't been thinking about it. So when Jesus says, what are you guys arguing with them about? Many times when he asked that question, he already knew. I wonder if there was emphasis on the word arguing. I wonder if all of a sudden it dawned on them, oh man, we fell for that again. Do you have anybody at work that just knows the thing to say to get you completely out of the spirit and completely in your flesh to where pretty soon, like Popeye, your face is turning red and your pipe is spinning around. You're like, so like I can't stand no more. You know? Some of us are related to people like that. Your enemy knows. So why the tattling of this guy? What this guy is basically saying, that what started this whole conflict was he came to his disciples with a need. I think this is very revealing, especially because they're men. They were brought a need which they couldn't meet. And then that's the perfect opportunity for there an argument to start. I have noticed that when people don't have a very solid position, they argue louder. Here's guys that failed in their mission, so to speak, and it's easy if you can pick a fight with somebody when your position is weak. If you can pick a fight with somebody and get them mad, then you can shift the whole thing over to them, and now you feel better about yourself because look at them, look at how they're losing their temper. I know this happens in marriages often. If you feel bad about yourself, suck somebody else into a fight, and then you can smugly accuse them of having a short fuse. None of you have ever done that, I know. So I'm talking to all those people in other countries that are listening online. So the guy in the crowd says, by the way, about tattling, I grew up with 5 sisters and 1 brother, all younger. And in my defense, I tattled because I knew they were going to lie through their teeth. When the court case was open, when it came to trial, especially in front of my Nazi stepmother, when it all came up in front of there, they were going to lie through their teeth to make themselves look better. So I, the bastion of truth protection, I had to speak the truth first. So that, you know, let it be on record before the court. At least in my demented mind, that's the way I thought about tattling.